Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and as always, here with Managing Editor and good friend, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. It's really good to see you again. Now, I understand that you're having a sort of a busman's holiday. You're supposed to be having a break, but here we are doing another podcast. You're on the lovely Gold Coast, and it looks like there's blue sky behind you. So that's excellent.
Yes. Having a bit of a break and nice to see some blue sky. So, Richard, today we're going to talk to another one of your friends. We're always talking to your friends.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the trouble is, I was saying to someone the other day, I think I was in the editorial, I said, it seems like only people who are our friends write for the magazine. But the thing is, we get to meet so many people. And when we do things, but I have seen Aldrich for a number of years at the Interpersonal Neurobiology Conference in the States, at UCLA in the States, which I've been going to for about 10 years. And, we just meet and chat. And the next thing, he's off. He's done all his stuff. He's got his PhD. He's out in the other side of the country, Miami. And he's written this incredible book called Reassembling Models of Reality that has come out in Norton in the Interpersonal Neurobiology series with a foreword by Lou Cozzolino and an afterword by Dan Siegel. So a lot of interest and attention.
Now, to get a taste of this book, we have assembled some excerpts from the book, or Richard has. And so in the current magazine, the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, grab a copy of that and you will be able to get a very good taste of what Dr. Aldrich Chan is on about.
Yes, that's our April issue for when people listen to this down the track.
Oh, yes, April 2021.
And so tell us a bit about Aldrich. Have you got a few about his details?
Let me pull up his bio here. So Dr. Chan, he's a clinical neuropsychologist, author and founder of the Center of Neuropsychology and Consciousness, a private practice in Miami, Florida, and provides neuropsychological and psychological services. He's also an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University and conducts research on the default mode network and trauma at the University of Miami. And we're going to touch on the default mode network in our discussion with Aldrich today.
Brilliant.
Now, Richard, I'd just like to remind all of our listeners that today we are being sponsored by BetterHelp. Richard, tell us a little bit about this sponsorship.
Well, BetterHelp is a very interesting organization that literally runs and organizes an online therapeutic program where it has therapists on one side and it attracts and draws clients towards it who want to work on the online space. Mm. So what's beautiful is for people who want to explore the online place or for people, particularly our friends who've found a lot of difficulty with all this COVID carry on and clients falling away, it's a great way to get some stability in your business. But what's beautiful is we've organized with them that you get a one-year subscription to the Science of Psychotherapy. So if you're already a subscriber, you get a 12-month extension. So that was the clincher for us. So we want you to go to BetterHelp, have a look, and if you're keen, wow, 12 months with us. Is that a good deal? I think so.
It is a good deal. And at the moment, this deal is only available for therapists registered in the United States. BetterHelp are expanding into Europe and hopefully other places. But just for the moment, this offer is just for those in the United States. Right. Fantastic. Now, Richard, let's go across to the United States. Dr. Aldrich Chan, thank you for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. It's so great to see you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And lovely to see you again, Richard, here. How are you doing? You're in almost foreign lands from the West Coast. You're over on the East Coast now.
That's right. I have to spread the word. What can I say?
No. Beautiful stuff. Now, Matt and I have just been talking about you, and we think you've actually done something really quite wonderful with this new book. Besides all the work, I'm sure your students and things are having a fabulous time with you, but Reassembling Models of Reality. Mm-hmm. Let that go. I think the title says a lot of stuff. What's going on there? What brought you to write this book? Because it goes into a lot of spaces.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm the type of person that carries, I would say, a low grade of existential dread through life. And, you know, there are moments where I have what I would say are non-clinical states of derealization. And when COVID struck, you know, it basically provided me with some time to focus on remedying some of the difficulties or challenges that I was having in the moment. And while I was looking through all the material that exists, I couldn't find anything that really integrated information from philosophy, neuroscience, and psychology. I found books, of course, that were very spiritually based or, you know, materialistic doctrines or, you know, and everything in between, but nothing that really put everything together. And it's especially in such a way that it can be applied in the clinical field. And I think that there is just, there's so much fascinating information and studies and movements that are going on right now that, you know, I decided to put the book together myself through various different, you know, research articles and philosophical writings and of course, the whole host of books from interpersonal neurobiology.
Now, this is a great service that Richard and I have been doing as well, gathering all of these various, you know, aspects of research and thought and bringing them together in an integrative manner, you know, for a very practical service, you know, to psychotherapists. And that's what we've seen you do in this book. And it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, there's this strange thing that we seem to have done in science that not many other people seem to do. I mean, I certainly agree with the idea of differentiating the elements and exploring their richness, but sometimes Matt and I were talking, I was saying it's like a mechanic who pulls out a carburetor and develops it and you know, makes it work better and, you know, increases the efficiency incredibly. Pretty much every mechanic that I could imagine would then put that carburetor back in the engine. But we don't in science. We put a fence around it and we give it a name and we tell everybody to that it's got nothing to do with anything else. It's very strange. So this type of discussion of the elements is surprisingly rare. So I'm really glad you've written the book. What sort of comments did you get from some of the different I could see in the early parts of it, the different fields. What sort of comments did you get from those sorts of people in different areas?
Well, I mean, the idea for the book really is to target the individual as an individual truly is, which is not simply an object. And that's sort of what science does. It objectifies things and everything within the lens of science. Everything becomes an object, but then we're missing the subject. And the truth is that we're all multifaceted individuals, and there are so many different angles which can tackle the different dimensions of human experience. And so really, each dimension of study really contributed to providing an integrated approach to really, you know, treat an individual as a whole. It's, I think, oversimplistic to think that we can adhere to one specific approach and ignore everything else when treating someone who's you know, suffering from, let's say, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, or actually anything, even a low-grade depression, you know, from the biological space all the way to the sociocultural and spiritual or existential, whatever word you want to use.
Yes, and this is a very humbling book that you've written as well. Because I mean, it was humbling me because it brought back to my awareness just how limited our perceptions are. I mean, I know you're sort of, the end game is to get us to explore more of what the client is experiencing, not from our own frame, but trying to understand their frame. But coming back to a bit more of the foundational things that you discussed, our perception of the world and of reality is extremely limited. And you've reminded us just how limited that is. You talk about, you know, the visual spectrum and how, you know, we only see a little tiny bit of that, and audio spectrum. And could you just expand a little bit on just how limited our perception is, and then sort of extrapolating from that, how possibly we shouldn't be so sure about what we're seeing and perceiving in front of us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when it comes to the visual spectrum, we only see about 1%. And really, when it even comes to visible matter, it's less than 5%. Now, of course, you know, we assume there's dark matter and that there's a lot more going on and forces that are beyond our understanding at this point in time. But the truth is that, you know, as human beings, we do really only sense and perceive a tiny, tiny fraction of what's happening. And that's just the beginning, because once the information becomes filtered through our sensory perception, it then becomes reinterpreted multiple times throughout our neural system. And Rakel estimated that 60 to 90% of the internal activity that's happening within our brains is actually internally generated, as opposed to being, you know, directly related to external stimuli. And of course, this then bridges us to what is going on within our brains, what is happening within these reinterpretive systems.
Yeah, yeah. So our brain really fills in the gaps, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a great example of that is really the optic nerve, right, which is a blind spot in both of our eyes. And you can easily see this with a little illusion by drawing a little dot on a piece of paper and, you know, positioning it in such a way that eventually you can see that based on the whiteness of the paper, that little black dot just suddenly disappears, because our brain is really projecting the most likely of circumstances onto the paper.
Yes, I mean, that's a beautiful, elegant way of describing it, but more fundamentally, we make it up. We just invent it. There was a lovely story, I can't remember if it was Ramachandran or one of those guys, but talking about a chap who had an enlarged blind spot, a large hole in the retina. So it was actually his gap was about the size of a basketball.
Wow.
And but he said, I could still wander around and perceive the world quite successfully, he said, but it was really useful, because if I was arguing with somebody and they were really starting to annoy me, I just adjusted my position so their head disappeared.
That's hilarious.
And so the brain does that aspect of... it reminds me of Lou Cozzolino's comments about parenting and various others in dance, that what we have in our conscious awareness is a good enough awareness, a good enough knowledge of the space in order to survive. What sort of thoughts does that prompt? And where in the book those aspects of, I mean, is it good enough to be what we are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say that our sensory perceptual system is so very complex to us. You know, when it comes down to it, it's in isolation, it's bound to make lots of mistakes, right? So you know, one example I give in the book is the simple idea of, you know, looking at the stars above at nighttime, right? And I used to play this joke on a friend of mine, and I would tell him, listen, how much money would you give me if I could show you the past? And, you know, they'd be like, oh, they'll give you $20, right? And I'll take them outside at nighttime and I'll show them the sky. And I'll say, well, there it is. There's the past, right? We would never have reached that conclusion if we were simply operating from a sensory perceptual, you know, mechanisms. So, you know, it does require very much the psychological, sociocultural, and again, the existential processes that are also composing who we are.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So we really do build the picture of our existence and our existence within an existence through all these mechanisms. As I say, if you're just out there doing it, what you see and feel, then it's one sort of thing. If you actually do these projections, these philosophical expansions, it's another sort of thing. And then if you do scientific investigation to try and peer deeper than our sensory perception allows, then you get another perception. And all those things have been happening now for, you know, 5,000-10,000 years in various degrees. And we suddenly arrive at this thing. And strangely, there's this idea that it should be perfect. But it seems to me from what you're saying in there that, you know, don't be surprised that you're having some, you know, mental, psychological or emotional issues. You're not that perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, the illusion goes even further to many different domains, right? If we think about time, for instance, we know it takes about 200 to 300 milliseconds for information to be registered into conscious awareness. And so everything is delayed by that amount of time. And then we consider the fact that the Earth is moving, it's rotating at a very rapid pace, yet we feel as if we are still in this moment, right? And then we go deeper, and then they tell us that you know, when we look at atoms, it's mainly, you know, 99% space in between. But I still see Matthew nodding his head, or I still see you, Richard. I don't see the space in between. And so, you know, really, I think evolution, and I'm in agreement with Don Hoffman's work, that, you know, evolution has really carved out a brain that is ultimately registering information based off of its fitness as opposed to its truth.
Right, yes.
And yeah, I almost feel like stopping for a couple of minutes and letting that sink in, its fitness rather than its truth. That's a beautiful, beautiful comment.
And fortunately, a lot of these illusions that our brain is making up is common amongst us, well, amongst most of us. And so we have this common experience of reality, quote unquote. But there is also an awful lot which isn't common, right? So I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about now we're trying to make the connection between the therapist and a client where things maybe aren't common in perception of reality.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of these, now we're transitioning now more into the cognitive domains, which would be the next chapter. And, you know, what we come to are a series of different, you know, defenses and cognitive distortions that have been, and self-regulation mechanisms from Gestalt that have helped us elucidate what sort of issues we may be, let's say, magnifying or polarizing or minimizing or whatever the case is. We also find that when it comes to cognition, we also have a memory problem, right? Where false memories and eyewitness testimony, as is very well known, has a very, very low rate of accuracy, and it's not very convincing, despite the confidence levels that some of these individuals may express. The confidence has absolutely no correlation with accuracy. And you know, that's where we run into some issues, right? When you're working with a patient who's, let's say, building their narrative off of a false memory or a false belief. To rewind just a little bit, the other thing that I think is important to mention, and bridging the sensory perceptual back in, is that there are many studies now that also look at sensory perceptual changes and how that can alter our judgments in reality or objectively speaking. I think there was one study that was looking at people who were sitting on a hard chair and they were interviewing people, and they ended up finding that their judgments were harder than they would have been made if they were sitting on a soft chair. You know, there's so many of these little studies that are potentially beneficial for us to be aware of, so that, you know, the next time you're sitting with a patient, you know, are you feeling hungry in the moment or are you in pain? And how is that going to interfere with your work? And what can you do to remedy it?
I don't know if you've read this study of judges, you know, coming up to sort of lunchtime and they're very hungry and their judgments were sort of a bit more severe until after lunch. And then they seem to be a bit less severe. So again, you know, their judgment was affected by their, you know, physical state.
This self-awareness is something that we're discouraged in some fields and areas where it's benign in others, and actually it's discouraged and held back, saying, no, what you know, you're disconnected, you're objective. But I think the one where it's encouraged, and which I am so grateful that serendipitously that this is my life, is that I spent 20 years as an actor, where I spent a lot, there was a lot of need to perceive your state, because it certainly affected your performance on one night for the other, you know, and of course I saw many others. I had the sort of interesting delight of talking to someone who did enjoy a little tipple of the bottle of something, and you could almost tell from her performance just how much she'd drunk. It altered the way in which she presented not only herself, but the representation of herself in her acting character. So
That was the, if anybody wants to do that, go to a live theatre and go see four or five different performances, and you will see. And if you could go back to the backstage and say, and how are you feeling tonight? Is it all well? I had pizza tonight, and I had curry the night before, and so on and so forth. So these are very strong elements. But I just want to. Pardon me for sort of running on. I just had that thought because we're going into these areas of consciousness and we're going to these states of mental things. And one of the things that everybody has sort of universally had a particular pull draw out in the book and in your writings is your discussions of the default mode network. Mm. Now, there are sort of three networks. John Arden's talked about this. Lou's talked about this. Dan's talked about this. Yours is really interesting. Could you just speak a little bit, give everyone a taste and get them so excited they have to go and buy the book?
Sure. So I guess I should begin by explaining what the default mode network is.
Yes, please.
So the default mode network is known as your resting state network. Now, it's a bit of a paradoxical title because your brain's never actually resting, right? But, basically it's involved with four core functions, with self-referential processing, social cognition, and your ability to mental time travel into the future to simulate a potential event or to retrieve an autobiographical memory. And so, I've embedded it into the chapter of self because, of course, all of these functions are very much related to your sense of self. But what's curious about this is that it would be easy for someone to make the leap that the default mode network might be the seat of the self. But that just can't be true because of these other networks that it works in tandem with. So it works with another network called the salience network, as well as the central executive network. And the salience network basically is the middleman that toggles back and forth between these states of the central executive network, which allows you to focus on a goal-directed task, versus the default mode network, in which case you're, again, an introspective process, engage in introspective processes. And so the central executive network and the default mode network, they're known as anti-correlated in the sense that when the DMN is functioning, it ultimately sort of shuts down the central executive network. And when the central executive network is online, we have the default mode network turning off. And so it's not like we lose our sense of self as soon as we're engaged in a specific task. It may recede into the background, but, we're still very much there. The DMN, I'm just going to start saying that because it's easier. And so the DMN can't be considered the seat of the self, although it can be seen as a supportive process for the self processes. But what's interesting now is that we all have a sense of self that's continual. So where is that sense of self? Or what is the sense of self, really? And so this is where I start delving into Northoff's work. And he suggested that the sense of self may be attributed to the discontinuity, actually, of multiple networks working together in tandem. So then we have to think about a sort of, so the discontinuity of neural activation corresponds to psychological continuity. That's the way to put it. And so we're thinking more here about a sort of gestalt happening, right? That the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But, really what it comes down to is when you break down these different processes of self, they too are subject to different illusions and alterations because the DMN can change. And we know that on the positive side, we know that from mindfulness. For example, we know that practitioners who've been engaged in mindfulness practices for many, many years have a DMN that looks a little different. One study found that the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is involved with multiple executive functions, comes online in their natural state. Now, on the flip side, we could look at PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Whereby we find a default mode network that seems to have regressed back to its earlier state. So the DMN doesn't stabilize until about 9 to 12 years of age. And then basically between 7 to 9 years old, there's a big difference between the two. And people with PTSD, they seem to regress back to that earlier state of self-processing. So yeah, that could be a nice intro to the DMN.
Yeah, no, it's fabulous. Matt and I talk a lot in the frame of
complex systems language and understanding. I'm pretty sure that's sort of in there. But this idea that we function with a series just emergent properties, that the emergent qualities and the mind, the self, and so many of the things as you discuss there, because this leads straight on to another, probably my favorite chapter heading, is I feel, therefore I am, when you're talking on the emotions. So here's another thing. So we've got this beautiful discussion there on the default mode network, and there's some great stuff there. But there's also this sense of that you talk about the relationship of the emotions to a self. Can you talk a bit about that aspect?
Yeah. So I'm a very big fan of Jack Panksepp's work, RIP, of course. And, you know, ultimately, when you look at the studies that he's conducted, he really identifies the core of consciousness, right? And that the core of consciousness really is an affective core. He identifies the seven primary process emotions, and ultimately the theory behind this is that consciousness is intimately connected and related to affect. And in fact, when we think about the role of consciousness, and I have to identify Mark Solms here in his work, it's the importance of feeling out different experiences or feeling out different things that are happening within and around us. And lots of times when we're conscious of something, it's because there's a problem of some sort. Otherwise, it doesn't need to be conscious. We don't need to consciously consider the different alternatives. And in which case, this highlights the importance of the unconscious, really, or you could consider the non-conscious, whatever terminology you would like to use, whereby, you know, if things are going well, you know, why spend all this energy and effort trying to fix it when there's nothing to fix? Whereas with consciousness, again, it's about feeling out an issue and then trying to resolve it in some form.
Now, this aspect of feeling an emotional distress, or what we might call a mental illness or a psychological disorder, how does, in that, you've already alluded to the answers that I'm sure you're going to give, but when someone has that sense of disruption, which might be feeling depressed or to be feeling anxious, or they might be having even sort of aspects of psychosis, delusional thoughts, but also these rapid movements, what sort of comments and frameworks do you put around that experience that the person is having and what they can do with it?
Yeah. So, you know, this now transitions into the way I view self-processes, really. In the sense that, I guess I'll start by saying that with the idea that the core of our sense of consciousness is affective, everything surrounds or orbits this affective core. So all the cognitive processes, you know, and thoughts and experiences, they tend to agglomerate around. And this really brings up complexes from Jungian work. And I've always been a huge fan of Carl Jung, and it wasn't until Panksepp's work came out that it clicked so well for me that I had to write about it, even though I know that certain people in the field are still fearful of you know, citing Jung for his ideas. But, you know, Jung himself actually in one of his books cited the brainstem as a potential candidate for the emergence of consciousness. And of course, we find that the subcortical midline structures identified by Panksepp is you know, theorized to be the core for the self. And when it comes to the theory of complexes, these are, you know, emotionally toned or emotionally charged sets of ideas that can occur at a non-conscious level. And so if someone is experiencing severe levels of anxiety, let's say, we know that generally speaking, that there's, you know, high amounts of limbic activity. And by the way, the limbic activity has to do with the secondary process for Panksepp. And these are very unconscious aspects or unconscious processes that are happening. So to go back, we have then, you know, these complexes that can form. So let's say someone, again, going back to the anxieties example, if someone has a huge fear of, has a lot of social anxiety, right? And they are unable to attend a specific event that's important to their friends. And they really want to go, but they're so fearful that something bad will happen or they'll say something and they'll make a mistake. You know, a part of it is really identifying the different emotions that the individual may express in session and sort of collapsing it down all the way to the primary process emotions and helping them and facilitating the processing of these emotions so that these complexes that have all these, you know, thoughts and biases that agglomerate around them can disperse and we could improve integration within.
Right. So we're breaking this complex down and then sort of reassembling in a more healthy way. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And is it taking them back to the engine or to the mechanics, like the steering wheel's not steering well, and it's not about holding the steering wheel more tightly, it's about going back to that fundamental system, as Panksepp described. How do you then work with that retooling of the system? Yeah.
So, you know, I think that there are various methods. And as you know from the book, I'm not completely married to any particular one.
Yeah, we like that.
Thanks. So, you know, when it comes to processing emotions, you know, there are pretty clear studies indicating that if you let sleeping dogs lie or if you suppress them, it doesn't do the individual any good as it comes back. Or if you distract yourself, which lots of people love to do, eventually they come back or it'll emerge in some other form. And so, you know, one practice that I've always been very supportive of are mindfulness-based practices, and specifically, you know, the idea of cognitive defusion that comes from ACT, which is really, you know, building distance from the emotions and thoughts that you're having and being able to simply observe them as opposed to identify them. So it's the sort of idea that there's a difference between being angry and feeling angry. Right. Whereas someone might be angry and punch a hole in the wall, someone else who's, let's say, engaged in this practice might be able to step back and view those emotions and experience them, but not act out. So instead of being reactive, they're responsive.
Right. So developing the observing self.
Right. Absolutely.
So this is what we would do as an actor. I mean, I always found it quite extraordinary. We're talking about it, the value of knowing the time when I was acting a character who was incredibly angry, but I was still having some sense of, not control so much, but I was able to be regulating that I was actually regulating the anger. So it's quite a fascinating thing, this observer-operator quality, which we're kind of not educated much about, but there's a lot that in your book allows us to see these dual capacities of functioning.
Yeah, I mean, as a therapist, that's what we, you know, have to do. If you've got a client who's generating some anger within you, you know, especially if it's like a personality disorder that you're dealing with, you have to have that capacity of the observer, right, to be able to recognize and, you know, maybe isolate those internal emotions that's going on inside of you to properly attend to the client that's in front of you.
Yeah, and I think that this is a nice bridge to the idea that existential systems, or at least the way I work, you know, lots of times I think it's important that there be a somewhat of a hierarchy within someone's psychological disposition, and this is where the existential systems kind of come into play, seeing them as the center to which all these biopsychosocial processes, again using the same analogy, tend to orbit. And the development of the observing self is definitely a first step to doing so. Because, of course, someone who's observing their emotions and thoughts, you know, they may be able to relate to them differently. But I think the limit of mindfulness, specifically for people who think of it as a cure, is that you can still have someone who has a mind full of maladaptive, biased emotions and thoughts and no good resource to draw from, right? And this is where sort of traditional methods really of insight and pattern recognition within sessions and helping people, you know, build up a more objective viewpoint of the world can be really, really important.
And now we've got had this wonderful background. I want to see if we can just spend a moment returning back to the title, because I think it actually has a lot of depth to it, because we talked about integration and we talk about integrating a lot in interpersonal neurobiology, but also in a lot of other fields, and they talk about that. And I think this word you've used at the beginning, reassembling, is not the same as just integrating. And I wonder if I'm picking up something or making up my own subtlety, but if you could speak to that particular, you know, that use of that word, it's really interesting.
Mm. Well, to be quite honest, I haven't thought of it that deeply. You know.
Whoops. I did.
It's fine. I mean, I can share with you my associations. And the truth is that everyone already has their minds assembled in some fashion. And when it comes to reassembling it, we're really trying to terraform what's going on, which is why I start the book with sensory perceptual, but then I even jump into some of the metaphysical propositions and movements that are going on right now. For myself, I mentioned earlier on that there's some low grade of existential dread that I carry with me, right? Truth be told, you know, like, so my family, they never ascribed to any particular religion. My grandparents were Protestant, but they never passed anything down. My parents believe in very different things. And I never grew up with any sort of religion. And basically, I was left to my own devices to develop my own sort of system of belief. And that was something that wasn't completely in place until I did the research and wrote this book and put it all together so I could come up with a coherent platform through which I'm operating. And even when we talk about all of the psychological techniques and so forth, there's no meta psychology that's really grounding our approaches. And so, you know, it's just so fascinating that right now that we are at a time where materialism itself is being challenged on the basis of the hard problem of consciousness, right? Which has to do with, you know, there is a likeness to our experience, and why aren't we just, you know, zombies that are operating, you know, on a knee-jerk basis when we can be? And so, of course, again, with all these different models that are coming up, I think it's helpful for individuals to explore some of these options, especially if you're like me and you don't really, you know, you're not really with any religion, nor do you believe in anything, you know, concrete. It's beneficial to really look at some of these and see what it is that resonates with you, and not just what resonates with you, but also what makes sense with the information and with the science that exists out there.
Yeah,
beautifully,
absolutely.
Integrating the salience network.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think it is very helpful to understand the very myopic view we do have of the world, the universe, everything, as you've outlined in your book. And to bring us back to reassess, well, what is it that I really believe? I'm just wondering, are there any sort of last words, rounding out things that you'd like to tell our audience?
That's a good question. I was going to jump into a whole other splurge, but I'm not.
Well, next time we get you back, we'll continue the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I would just suggest that, you know, everyone be open, very very open minded to all the different approaches that are out there, because every theory that has arisen comes out for a reason, you know, and they each represent some aspect of human nature. And I think it's overly simplistic and silly to disregard one approach over another. So again, I think that, you know, integrating and of course tailoring these approaches to, you know, whatever patient you have in front of you and collaboratively work with them and adjust as necessary is very important. And when it comes again, and I'll just a brief note on the metaphysical portion of it all, I think that holding an agnostic stance whenever patients bring up, you know, different forms of religion or spirituality or culture is important. And your ability to kind of slide, you know, left and right between what I've mentioned in the book as the noumenal phenomenal axis can be very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we need people to read this book and get you back sometime a few months down the track, because we've scratched beautifully on the surface, but I'm pretty sure there's a lot more that people will be able to appreciate once they've had a bit of a look through the book. So we really recommend they read it.
Yeah, Richard, I'm feeling the same. I feel like we've just really skimmed across sort of a really deep pool of wisdom here. So would love, to come back and maybe pick one or two and go a bit deeper.
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's very nice to see you again, Richard, and very nice to meet you, Matt.
Good to meet you too. We'll catch you next time then.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye for now. I know, as I said, I've known Aldridge for quite a while, but even I was surprised at the extent of his understanding and his knowledge.
Yeah.
That was really interesting about the default mode network and, oh, just everything.
Yeah, look, the entire work is such a mammoth undertaking, and he's just done a remarkable job. So once again, just would really encourage listeners, if you're interested, well, first of all, you can have a read of a few of the excerpts in our magazine, in our April 2021 issue of The Science of Psychotherapy. And of course, the book, which we'll leave links in the show notes so you can go straight to that.
Fantastic. And so, everybody, we've been doing a lot of work on while we're in between all this on the Academy. So Matt mostly, because he's more brilliant at that than me, but gathering together the information, making it more accessible and increasing the volume of the content. So for those of you who are with us and already subscribers, go in and check out what we've done if you haven't been in for the last few weeks. And for those who are interested, then please go in and look, and maybe you want to come to us through the BetterHelp program. It's all just up to you.
Yeah, so just to clarify that, Richard, in the scienceofpsychotherapy.net, we've gathered together all of our content into six core resources, and we're hoping that this is a much easier way to navigate all of the content, and also a way that you can get in, get into the content, ask questions. We've got discussion parts associated with every little module, so it's living, it's growing. We're going to be adding to this all of the time, and we want you involved as a community as well.
Beautiful. So come on aboard, join us, and be with the crazy Australian guys.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Richard, well, it's been a pleasure, as always. And thank you, everyone, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we'll catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.